You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by SEIU Healthcare and the Kansas City Building Trades. SEIU Healthcare, Missouri, Kansas, unites hospital, nursing home, and home care workers across Missouri and Kansas. Workers provide essential care to our patients, seniors, and people with disabilities. We're committed to quality care and fighting for quality jobs for all essential healthcare workers in Missouri and Kansas. And the Kansas City Building Trades Council. They're the men and women who build KC. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Kansas City native Thomas Frank has a new book about American populism and the long line of elites who hate it. It's called The People? No! A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Find out why pundits called Donald Trump a populist and why he's nothing of the kind. We've got Tom Frank for the hour. In the news, Biden fires NLRB general counsel within minutes of assuming office. And did you know that Trump's a union member? Our feature at the end of the show is Your Right, Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. She's going to talk about executive orders. And now for the news. The news from our side, January 21st, 2021. The inauguration of Joe Biden as president and the departure of Donald Trump has brought tremendous relief and hopefully a better night's sleep to millions and especially labor activists and leaders. In one of his first moves as president, Biden fired Peter Robb, the anti-union general counsel at the National Labor Relations Board. Bloomberg Law reported yesterday at 2:12 p.m., just minutes after Biden assumed office, that the new president had told Robb to quit or be fired. Then the story was updated at 8:42 p.m. to say Robb was fired when he refused to resign. One can assume that Robb's departure was a top priority of the administration and clearly a nod to organized labor that their concerns will be addressed. Robb is the first general counsel of the NLRB to be fired. Trump had appointed him to the position, which was confirmed by the Senate. He had 10 months more in his term. The White House sent Robb an email telling him to resign by 5 p.m. or be fired just minutes after Biden was sworn in on Wednesday. Robb, however, had other ideas, saying that he wouldn't resign because it would set a bad precedent, politicize a job that was supposed to be independent of the president, and belie Biden's desire to foster civility and unity. Robb was a management attorney who helped Ronald Reagan bust the PATCO Union of Air Traffic Controllers in 1981, an event which began widespread attacks on unions by corporations. He has pushed an aggressive pro-business, some called toxic, agenda at the Labor Board. SEIU and CWA unions had urged Biden to break with precedent by forcing Rob out immediately in order to begin reorienting the agency toward protecting workers, something it hasn't done for 4 years. Biden also yesterday named Democrat Lauren McFerrin to head the NLRB, replacing John Ring, the Republican chairman since 2018, who presided over major business-friendly decisions during the Trump administration. But it will take until August for Democrats to get a majority of appointees on the labor board. Once that occurs, and a replacement for Rob wins Senate confirmation, the board can begin reversing the Trump-era changes to agency anti-union rules and procedures.
PAI reports, yesterday AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said, "Today we celebrate Inauguration Day. We look forward to working with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to enact a pro-worker agenda." He then posted labor's goals on the Fed's website at workersfirstagenda.org and urged people to sign at a link there demanding that Biden and Congress enact its measures. Trumka said, "Working people have been struggling far too long against unfair wages, benefit cuts, and attacks on our right to form a union in our workplaces. That ends now. Our Workers' First agenda is about all of us, with no exclusions, because the real recovery working families need, expect, and deserve is impossible without equity." Trumka did not mention unity, which was the theme of Biden's inaugural address, but Biden never mentioned labor or working people either. The Workers' First agenda has 5 priorities. First is worker empowerment. Pass the PRO Act, a powerful bill that would repeal much of the anti-labor Taft-Hartley Act passed 74 years ago. The next is worker safety and the pandemic, which means testing, vaccine, an OSHA rule on COVID, and adequate PPE. Third is good jobs and public investment, which includes a huge list of demands from infrastructure renewal to trade and immigration policy changes. Fourth is racial justice and democracy, which calls for a racial equity czar to lead an interagency task force to survey and address the structural racial equity issues in jobs, healthcare, criminal justice, and policing. Finally, the agenda calls for economic security, which means pension funding relief, increasing Social Security benefits, reducing prescription drug prices, lowering the Medicare eligibility to age 50, creating a public option, strengthening the Affordable Care Act, rebuilding the unemployment insurance system, and establishing postal banking. Notably absent are demands to address climate change or for Medicare for All.
Did you know that Donald Trump's a union member? Well, duh. He was on Celebrity Apprentice, a union shop. But maybe not for long. Not only does he face an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, but he's also going to face a trial in his union, SAG-AFTRA, because they want to expel him. Jeremy Fuster of The Wrap writes, on Tuesday, the National Board of SAG-AFTRA announced that it will hold a disciplinary hearing against Trump, and he could face expulsion from the Actors Guild. The board made the move to hold the hearing after a request from SAG-AFTRA President Gabrielle Carteris, who cited the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th and Trump's role in inciting the attack as grounds for expulsion. The hearing will be overseen by the Guild's Disciplinary Committee, which did not participate in the National Board's vote on approving the hearing, Carteris said. Carteris said, "Donald Trump attacked the values that this union holds sacred. Democracy, truth, respect for our fellow Americans of all races and faiths, and the sanctity of the free press." There's a straight line from his wanton disregard for the truth to the attacks on journalists perpetrated by his followers. David White, National Executive Director, said, "Our most important role as a union is the protection of our members. The unfortunate truth is this individual's words and actions over the past 4 years have presented actual harm to our broadcast journalist members." Trump joined SAG-AFTRA predecessor SAG and AFTRA in 1989, the same year he appeared on the John Derrick film Ghosts Can't Do It. Trump would go on to make cameos in films like Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, The Little Rascals, and Zoolander. He also appeared in TV shows like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Spin City, Sex in the City, before leaving his biggest mark on pop culture with the reality series The Apprentice in 2004. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel. Stay tuned for our interview with Thomas Frank, preceded by Jen Lowe. Jennifer Lopez singing at the presidential inauguration yesterday the song This Land Is Your Land, which is a very populist song.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking down that ribbon of high, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. Oh, this land. Oh, this land. This land was made for you and me.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Thomas Frank is no stranger to the Heartland Labor Forum. He's been on the show to talk about at least three of his books before. What's the Matter with Kansas? The book that inspired me to actually drive to Lucas, Kansas to visit the Garden of Eden in a snowstorm. The Wrecking Crew, my personal favorite because I finally understood the buildup to Reagan. And Listen Liberal, the book I wish my dad had been able to read. Tom Frank is, of course, one of the latest Kansans to achieve national fame as a culture critic, historian, and the guy who makes sense of this crazy political world we live in. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Judy, great to be here. That's funny that you drove all the way to Lucas, Kansas. Look what I've got in my hand. You can see this on the camera.
Oh, yes, I have that in my bathroom.
The Labor Crucified. It's one of the sculptures out at, it's my favorite of all of his things out at Garden of Eden.
It's actually on the wall in my bathroom.
I have it on my wall here in my office right next to the picture of John Brown from the Capitol building in Topeka.
Oh, right, I love that picture. Yeah, that is one of the scariest pictures I've ever seen.
When I was a kid, they would take us up there on field trips. And it's no one realizes how big it is. It's like John Brown himself is like, he's colossal. He's like twice life size. And it's actually frightening, the picture.
No, he scares kids, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's so gigantic.
Yeah. Well, he also looks really demented.
He looks fierce. Yeah. He's howling, you know?
So anyway, my social justice book club read your book and discussed it earlier this month, and they have contributed some of the questions I'm going to ask you. So I want to start by getting some definitions, because I think a lot of people don't know what populism is. And the book that we're talking about is called The People Know, or say it yourself, Tom. How do you say it?
The people? No.
That's it.
And so Carl Sandburg wrote a famous book-length poem back in the 30s called The People, Yes, the celebration of ordinary mm-hmm. Americans. Uh-huh. And the idea is that we're living in a very different time than that, when no one wants to celebrate ordinary Americans. So at least no one on my side.
Right.
The aisle. So yeah, so it's the title is the flip side of that.
Right. And this is a brief history of anti-populism, which we'll get to. You know, back in the days of his political debut in 2015, gliding down the escalator, Trump was labeled by the media a populist because he appealed to the masses with his nationalistic rhetoric, promising to clean the swamp, return jobs to the U.S., and portraying himself as an outsider. I heard this and I said, that's not populism. Obviously, you did too. And you went on to write a book about why. So tell us, why isn't Trump a populist? Why do you think the pundit class erroneously labeled him as one?
The way the pundit class uses the word populism, they use it as a kind of synonym for racist demagogue. And that usage of the word was out there already, but it was around, it was sort of floating around, but it was in conflict with the sort of original definition of the word, which is someone who's concerned about economic democracy, you know, a sort of Bernie Sanders kind of character. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, the sort of traditional American definition of the word. But thanks to Trump and thanks to Brexit in England, this kind of alternative definition just completely conquered everything. And now it's commonly used as the only definition, and people look at you funny if you use the word to mean, you know, something sane,
something good.
This sort of traditional thing. Yeah, something good. But, you know, I'm from Kansas and the first time I heard the word used that way, I was just like, now, wait a second, that's not populism. And, it annoyed me more and more and more that I wound up writing a book about it. But the thing is that you realize real quickly, you know, look, the definitions of words change, and it's kind of a ridiculous mission to go out there and complain about the definition of a word changing. What's far more interesting is to look at why the definition of the word changed, who is responsible for changing it, why did they do this, you know, and what do they mean by it? And that's, once you start digging down into that, it's a very interesting story. So what I do is I trace the kind of history of genuine populist movements in American life, but also the history of people who hate populism. Mm-hmm. And that, Judy, is absolutely fascinating, because there's this strong, I shouldn't say undercurrent, because it's in some ways it's dominant, this cultural current in American life of despising mass movements of working people. My book starts in the 1890s with the birth of populism, you know, the people who actually invented the word. But I'm sure you could trace it back earlier than that. But I trace anti-populism from the 1890s up to the present, people who absolutely hate and despise and fear mass movements of working class people.
So this is basically a history of the opposition to popular change in America going through our history, at least since the 1890s.
Yeah, that's right. It's a history of progressive left-wing movements, and also of people who hate those movements. And then down to our own time, when everything goes through the looking glass, you know, and everything is upside down, and Richard Nixon is a populist, and
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
So you didn't tell us why Trump isn't a populist.
Well, just think of the things that you mentioned, you know, he's this bellicose nationalist. Well, look, if your definition of populism doesn't explain the people who made up the word, the original populists in the 1890s, then your definition is wrong. And to say that bellicose nationalism is a feature of populism, well, no, it isn't. Or the racist sentiments, the bigotry that he aroused, all that. The populists were not the bigots of their age. They were the guys on the other side. They were the good guys of the 1890s. You go down the list. Trump does have a certain way of talking that resonates for a lot of working class people. And he does, I'll give him this, he occupies a kind of populist space in a kind of left-wing space in our political system. So you got to look at this in the larger picture, Judy. the left-wing party in America, I should say the party of the left in our two-party system, which is the Democrats, has for, you know, 40 years now has really not been interested in being a traditional party of the left. And so what you see happening is these sort of other movements and other figures rising up to kind of occupy this position formerly filled by the Democratic Party, but doing it without actually, so pretending to care about working people without actually doing anything for them, coming up with all of these culture war ways of reaching out to working people without actually helping them out economically. So, you know, traditional parties of the left are about economic reforms that will benefit working class people. That is the definition of the left. Going all the way back. And then you have, you know, a bunch of other features of it, but that's the central feature of it. And so you have the right in America, and Trump didn't originate this, by the way. Trump was very upfront about it, but he didn't invent this strategy. Right. This strategy of reaching out to working class voters without actually doing anything for them. Just as an aside, I've been reading a biography. You're gonna snicker at this. I've been reading a biography of George Bush the first. George H.W. Remember the dad? George
H.W.
Reagan's vice president, who then became president. And he ran for president in 1988 in like one of the most outrageous culture war campaigns ever. It's all they did was debate the culture wars, crime and flags and the Pledge of Allegiance.
Wasn't that the Willie Horton campaign?
Yes, the Willie. Yes, exactly. I had forgotten so much about that campaign, but it's just like, it makes me furious all over again to realize how long they've been playing this game, and it succeeded. So Michael Dukakis, who is the Democrat who comes out, refused to call himself a liberal and would say things like, it's all about competence, not ideology. You know? And he's like not particularly liberal. He's not like particularly doesn't really care about, you know, about economic issues on the left. You know, he just wants to rule as a kind of consensus moderate. He's very similar to the like to a Obama or a Bill Clinton or a Hillary Clinton, for that matter. And he was like 18 points ahead of Bush after the Democratic convention, and Bush just kicked the crap out of him with these culture war issues.
It's just a fraud.
Yeah, it is a fraud. The populist movement in the 1890s, which is the last great third party movement in American history, and, you know, was a kind of labor party. It would have been a sort of American equivalent of the labor party. Only the difference is it was largely based on farmers. It did have industrial workers too, but farmers were, there's a lot more of them at the time. They were more radical at the time, that sort of thing. But it was a radical left-wing party. It was obsessively concerned with economic issues, and then secondarily with issues of political corruption and opening up the franchise to more and more people, you know, making it easier to vote, that sort of thing. Pressing the will of the people on more and more things.
As,
you know,
as I recall, the populists, one of their biggest issues was monopoly.
Yeah.
And particularly
right.
The railroads and the yep. monopoly of the railroads. And in that, they allied with the Knights of Labor, which was, it was on the decline at that point, but it had been the largest labor organization in the country just a few years before.
That is correct. So when the populists, it took years for them to launch themselves as a third party. And what you had is you had groups like the Knights of Labor. You had other labor groups. Of course, the AFL was around. They were very conservative, though. You had elements in the AFL that weren't that conservative. And then you had all of these farm organizations that are, if you know what the Farmers Union is today, these organizations that were very similar to that. There was a bunch of them in the South. There was a bunch of them in the North. There was one that was for black farmers. Historians refer to this group as the Black Populists. And it took a number of years for them to decide to become a political party, to go into politics, as they put it. And when they finally did, they wrote a famous manifesto in 1892 called the Omaha Platform. They were meeting, obviously, in Omaha, Nebraska. But they say this is a union of the working class of America. These are all the different organizations of working people are going to come together and form this third party. And we're going to, we're going to challenge the two main parties all over the country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And for a while, it looked like after 1892, it looked like they might actually succeed. They were growing and growing and growing. The economy went into a terrible recession.
Right.
There were these huge strikes. The first ever March on Washington happened in 1894. A populist led this march.
That was Coxey's Army.
Right? Coxey's Army, totally forgotten today.
And you had the Pullman strike.
That's right, led by Eugene Debs, who then became a populist. And then everything went south. A big part of them got absorbed by the Democrats. A lot of them wouldn't have anything to do with the Democrats. And they started to fight among themselves. And they were gone by about 1898, certainly by 1900.
And the racial unity that they had really pioneered in the South went to hell, right?
Yeah, fell apart. Yep. In the South, they had a very radical strategy for the time. I mean, now it just seems like common sense, where they said, you know, this is at a time when in most Southern states, blacks could still vote. So this is about 1892, around in there. The sort of reigning ideology in the South was that this idea of what they called white solidarity, that white people's interests were, that their interests as white people was paramount to everything else. And that, so for that reason, poor white farmers had to vote for whoever the monopoly party of the South put up. And the monopoly party at the time was the Democrats. The Democrats were, they called them the Bourbon Democrats. They were very conservative. It was ruled by the ruling class of the South ran the party. It was obviously, you know, massively racist. The populists came into the South and said, here's what we propose. The interests of farmers, whether you're black or white, your interest as a farmer is more important than your interest by race. And so therefore, they reached out to black farmers and said, join us, the white farmers. And at first, it succeeded. There's all sorts of very famous examples of this message resonating for people. These were very poor people, people whose way of life was being destroyed before their eyes. They were really going downhill. And so they grabbed hold of this. But within a few years, the sort of ruling elite of the South had unleashed the most incredible racist campaigns all over the South in order to crush populism. And they succeeded, and in a lot of places by violence.
One of the most interesting parts of the book to me was in the chapter where you talk about this, and you quote Martin Luther King, and we're recording this on Martin Luther King Day. And so I thought I would read, I thought this was really interesting, that Jim Crow and the Jim Crow laws were in part a response to the threat of the racial unity that the populists were building.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you quote Martin Luther King to say, and when his wrinkled stomach cried out for the food that his empty pockets could not provide, talking about white Southerners, he ate Jim Crow. A psychological bird that told him that no matter how bad off he was, at least he was a white man, better than the black man, and he ate Jim Crow.
Yeah. And anyway, so that's in his famous speech that King gave, and he gave that speech in March of 1965. I remember that easily because it was within a week of when I was born, the day I was born. On the steps of the Capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama. This is at the very end of the Selma to Montgomery march. And it's a moment of supreme triumph for Martin Luther King. Congress is working. They're going to get the Voting Rights Act passed. So it's for him. It's the, you know, it's one of his great moments and one of his great speeches. You can watch it on YouTube. It's one of the all-time classics. And he gives a shout out in the speech to the original populist movement in the 1890s. He says, where did these awful laws, where did Jim Crow come from? Because when he gives his speech, they're at the very end of Jim Crow. Jim Crow is going down all over the South. You know, they're not going to be able to do segregation by law any longer. And so he says, let's look back. Where did this system come from? And it is really interesting that it was invented. It was devised as a way of making sure that something like populism never happened again, that there would never be another effort to bring together poor whites and poor blacks in the South. And that's actually, you know, what's funny about that is that we look around us and all these people using the word populism just willy-nilly to mean whatever the hell they want. When Martin Luther King used it, it was clinically exact. He's actually historically totally correct in the way that he uses that word. That's one of the things that I really like about that speech. Do you want to hear the irony of it?
What?
His great foe at the time sitting in the, while he's giving that speech on the steps of the Capitol building, the man sitting behind the governor's desk was George Wallace, King's arch rival, who'd sent those, you know, the state troopers to beat up the marchers at Selma. By the end of the 1960s, everybody is calling George Wallace a populist.
You know, I wondered about it. That's right.
It's just like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, we got to take a break. We're talking to Thomas Frank about his book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. We'll be back in a minute.
KKFI would like to ask you to join a group of volunteer listeners who are interested in helping us achieve our goal of constantly improving the quality of the KKFI listening experience. Please join our team of community program evaluators who will assist in our program evaluation process. An online training session will be required, and team members will be expected to evaluate an assigned show every 2 to 3 months or so. If you think you might be interested in volunteering in this way, please go to www.kkfi.org/volunteer and look for current opportunities, or call us at 816-931-3122 and ask to speak with the station manager.
Thanks for listening to KKFI. Be sure to like and follow your community radio station on social media at KKFI 901 FM. And thanks for 30 years of support.
We're back. I'm Judy Ansel. This is the Heartland Labor Forum, and we're talking to Thomas Frank about his book about populism called The People Know. It's actually about anti-populism. What is anti-populism?
Well, it's that would be people who are hostile to populist movements. So beginning in the 1890s, when you had a real populist challenge, you had the populists, the people who invented the word, were sort of running around in America, contesting elections and so on. You had a kind of reaction of the American elite, of the upper classes of America. They came together to stamp this movement out, and they denounced populism, and by extension, all working class movements, in this very particular way. Okay, they said these are movements of hayseeds, of ignorant people who have no business running things. These are anti-intellectuals, people who don't understand modernity, people who don't understand modern life. These are people who are in the grip of mental illness. Most importantly, it's mob rule. Populism represents mob rule. By the way, I was just reading the New York Times the other day, and they used it to describe the rioters at the Capitol.
So are those guys populists or anti-populists?
The people at the Capitol? Well, they're not either. They're like, these are like seriously deluded people. It always fascinates me when, and I've thought about this a lot, maybe it shouldn't fascinate me, but I've always been fascinated by people who believe conspiracy theories, believe things that are so obviously patently wrong, and are willing to actually commit crimes on the basis of things that are palpably false. But no, those people aren't populists, and they're not anti-populists either. Anti-populists generally attack working class movements with the various criticisms that I just mentioned. I would add one more to it, which is to say that working class people are always bigots. And this is a critique that started on the right. They didn't do the bigotry part in the 1890s because they couldn't, right? That wouldn't have made sense. No one would have criticized populism for being a movement of bigots in the 1890s because A, they weren't, and B, the elites of America were themselves so extremely racist that it wouldn't make sense for them to accuse anybody else of being racist. You know what I'm saying? So they that aspect of it only came up later. You see the exact same critique today, but in the 1890s, this is a critique leveled by the right. They didn't call themselves the right. They would have called themselves men of standing, you know, in the community, the people who own America, the sort of ruling class of America. That's who criticized the populist movement in this way. And what you find is that criticism, that bill of criticism, all those different critiques that I mentioned, that working class movements are a form of mob rule, that they are anti-intellectual, that they are in the grip of mental illness, that they are hypnotized, you know, by some demagogue, that kind of thing. This comes up again in the 1930s as a criticism of the New Deal and of the labor movement. And you see it all over the place with a lot of eugenics mixed in, because that was science, right, in the 1930s.
Right. So was the New Deal populist?
Absolutely. Very much was, so. Was I mean, they use that language all the time, the populist language of you know, the...
Was FDR a populist?
Well, so he didn't use that word. No one used that word at the time to mean as a generic term. It was in the 1930s, that word was only used as a proper noun to describe a movement, a third party from the 1890s. But he used populist language all the time. He got a lot of the populist program enacted into law. And historians at the time in the 30s and 40s definitely saw Roosevelt as a neo-populist. You know, I quote some of them in the book. They would say this.
Let me argue with you a little bit, because, you know, there are a lot of people who say that, you know, what FDR did, essentially, despite all the right wingers who were opposed to him, was save capitalism in America. And that, in fact, while he made the reforms of the New Deal, he was fundamentally somebody that saved the system.
Yeah, well, that's not unpopulist of him, you know.
Okay,
so I don't know if I would agree with that. That is a kind of comforting way of looking at Roosevelt that became popular in the 1950s during the consensus years, but it doesn't really, to say something like that doesn't get at the kind of heat and the fire of the 1930s. Roosevelt was fiercely opposed by the ruling elite of his day. They absolutely hated. Right. And they denounced him using the most extreme language available in the English speaking world. And then they did everything they could to try to stop this guy. So it is comforting to say that he saved the system. And there's a certain amount of truth to it, because what if he turned out to be another Hoover?
Uh-huh.
You know, you certainly the system would have collapsed. I mean, the system was already at the breaking point. You know, people were, if you look, go back and read about the early 30s, a third of the nation was unemployed. Every bank in America was closed the day Roosevelt took office, because, you know, there had been so many bank runs, they declared bank holidays all over America. In a lot of cities, people had been reduced to barter. Look, the system was collapsing. There's no question about it. And in that sense, yeah, he saved the system. But that's not unpopulist of him. The populists, they weren't Marxists.
So, yeah, okay, that's, and that's one of my book club members wanted to know, what's the difference between populism and socialism?
Well, that's another thing people used to debate all the time, that it seems pointless to debate now, because we don't even know what populism is anymore. But like historians back in the 30s and 40s used to argue about that. Was populism a form of socialism? And they argued that it had socialist elements in it, like populism. They wanted to nationalize the railroads. They wanted to nationalize the telegraph, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We never did that, by the way. We just regulated these things instead. But they also would say, well, it couldn't be a real socialist movement because farmers are landowners. And so therefore they don't want a dictatorship of the proletariat. And look, that's true. These guys were not communists. They did not trace their intellectual origins to Karl Marx. They just didn't. They were totally homegrown. They knew who Marx was. If you go back and read their newspapers, they sold a lot of books to one another out of their newspapers. And so they knew who Marx was. For them, the leading thinker was Thomas Jefferson. So everything goes back to Jefferson. They were big fans of Henry George, the single tax guy. Probably their leading intellectual was a guy called Henry Demarest Lloyd, who's totally forgotten today, but he wrote about monopoly power. He was a journalist that wrote about a lot of early books about monopoly power. They were really into like Edward Bellamy, who was a kind of quasi-socialist, but no, they were not Marxists.
Yeah. Okay.
In a European sense.
Let me fast forward here to the present, because I want to make sure I ask you about both liberals and Democrats.
Yeah.
You know, and you talked about the tremendous crisis of the 1930s, of the Great Depression. And of course, we're in a tremendous crisis right now, both a public health crisis as well as an economic crisis. So why don't we have another FDR? Why don't we have another movement like the 1930s? Would you talk about the Democrats?
Yeah. So there's one more crisis that you overlooked, which is the crisis of authority. that the Democrats here in Washington talk about constantly, which is the public's mulish refusal to bow down to credentialed academic authority, to respect the sort of like the State Department, to respect the sort of the foreign policy community, to respect the people that run the great think tanks of Washington. They talk about this constantly. And there is a real sense here in Washington that what really ails us is, well, the problem is the people. The problem is not that our system has done anything wrong. The problem is that the people don't believe in the system anymore. This attitude, this crisis of authority that I'm talking about, they have a perfect example before them. Now all these people that believe in this insane conspiracy theory, you know, QAnon, that just stormed the Capitol building. And so they say, look at this. We've got to do something about the people. Now, if you ask me about it, Judy, I say, well, that's like, what, 5,000 people? These are deluded people that self-selected and came to Washington and did something incredibly stupid. They're not representative of anybody except for this hardcore of really deluded Trump supporters.
Okay, but let me ask you this, though. You know, one of the things you point out about the populists is how much they read. You end the book by talking about Emanuel Haldeman Julius, the publisher of Girard, Kansas.
Yes, yeah.
You know, who sold these little blue books for a nickel of all the great literature to working people who consumed it like crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, the working class reads much less than they used to do that.
Oh, everyone does, Judy.
Okay.
Reads anymore. I sell books for a living. I'm here to tell you. They don't read enough.
Right. And it must be a tough career. Anyway, but we're also, completely inundated by all kinds of propaganda with, we can't even tell the difference between truth, fact, and fiction anymore.
I know.
So, So how is it that, you know, like we can expect that working class people or the common man is the wisest,
well, you can't, Judy, but by that same token, the elites are spectacularly ill-informed themselves. I mean, that's the whole story of this book is, you know, especially the last chapter, we have this whole sort of debate in DC about how the people need to learn to respect elites again, you know, this crisis of authority, the people need to learn to respect elites. And what they never take into consideration, and I do mean never, is that there's a really good reason for people to not, you know, respect elites, which is that elites have screwed things up really badly over the last 20 years. I mean, they just keep blundering.
And you're talking about both Democrats and Republican leaders.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, you know, and the worst blunders are the consensus ones where everybody agrees on them, like the Iraq war, you know, the financial crisis. They all come together and do these incredibly stupid things. And I don't just mean political elites, of course. I'm talking about credentialed authority across the board, professionals and professionalism across the board, making mistake after mistake after mistake. You know, we're in a new era in American life, Judy, where I wouldn't want to say when this era began or anything, but there is now a huge divide between people with advanced degrees and people who didn't go to college. And
you're talking about an economic divide?
I'd say a sociological divide, because it's bigger than economics. You know, I have an advanced degree, and so I live around people who have advanced degrees, and their contempt for ordinary Americans is absolutely overwhelming. And I don't know if it's always been that way in this country. I don't think it has. I mean, you go back and look at a time like the 1930s, which was admittedly a very populist decade in terms of cultural style, you know, a decade that really believed in the common sense of ordinary people. And that kind of snobbery existed, but it was extremely unpopular. Well, snobbery is in the saddle today, I'm here to tell you, Judy. I mean, you just turn on TV and it's like, I was downstairs exercising this morning and I had CNN on, and they had some guy from the CIA talking about like what deluded fools ordinary Americans are. And this is like, CNN and the CIA are in bed together selling liberalism to us. It's like, what the hell is what has happened to this country? What happened to the liberalism that I grew up with? That's not my liberalism.
Yeah. What do you think of this common thing that a lot of people I know say is they wonder, why is it that people can't vote in their own interests, and they keep voting for candidates who don't.
Well, isn't that the big question? I mean, what's the matter with Kansas was an exploration of that question.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that I found, Judy, and you remember, and I came up with answers for that. Right. I mean, that's the whole idea of the book, is like, what the hell is going on here? And why is this happening? And why are good people whose ancestors were actually quite radical, why are they falling for this? And what I've found instead over the years is that people remember the question and they don't remember the answer. They remember that I asked that question.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't remember that there that there's an answer for it, which is that the answer that I focused on at the time is that the culture wars are framed as class war. Every single one of them is framed as a battle of you against the elite. Earlier, we were talking about this campaign in 1988, the ultimate culture war presidential campaign when George Bush Sr. Right. was running against Michael Dukakis. And he beat Dukakis by making the entire election into just one culture war after another, just constantly, constantly, constantly. And in this way, the preppiest man in America, George Bush Sr., was able to sort of camouflage his elitism, his upper classness, and make Michael Dukakis come off as the snob in the race and basically flip the class tables on him. And they did this mm-hmm. deliberately. He was advised by this guy, Lee Atwater, in doing this. And that's what culture war, it turns out that's what culture wars are always about. Is about sort of, and once you start looking, you see this everywhere. The right has come up with all of these different ways of mobilizing people's class anger, you know, working class people, of mobilizing their bitterness and resentment. And I think their bitterness is totally justified, by the way, but channeling it in ways that are that managed to get Republicans elected in scarce. Little else. Like, look, they got Donald Trump elected. Hooray. Then he cut taxes for the rich and he deregulated polluters, you know, nice going. But that's the Republican two-step. That's what they do. And the Democrats, they have their role in this, which is basically, this is the Democrats are the natural party of working people, but they have wandered so far afield from that over the last 40 years. And this is another subject that I've written about at great length, Judy, as you know, because we talked about it before, that they've given up on these people. And so, look, you've got a huge part of the population of this country that is not really represented by either party. And both parties make their pitch to them, but the Democrats, you know, look, what is their pitch? They've basically given up on it, on trying to reach a lot of these people. You know, they nominate a nice, friendly guy like Joe Biden, and he's just got this grandfatherly way, and everybody likes him. But other than that, they've got very, very little.
So what should we do about this? Do we need a third party, or do you actually believe that the Democratic Party could go back to its roots or reform itself or give up on its elitism and get back to respecting the working class?
Well, I've always said the Democrats have to reform themselves and change themselves. The prospect of them actually doing that is very slim. Things move by a logic and a force of their own that you and I that I don't know if humans have the power to disrupt. I think of things that would disrupt it, and one of them would be a terrible economic depression. Another would be if people started forming unions again, if you had another great organizing wave like in the 1930s, mm-hmm. Maybe if the Democrats nominated a guy like Bernie Sanders. But I think if that happened, you'd see there would be some cataclysmic reaction in the other direction.
Here's one from Lucy in my book club. She says, "You are well known for your withering critique of liberals in the Democratic Party. You even wrote a book about it. And toward the end of this book, you talk about liberal Democrats constantly scold Trump supporters for their uncouthness. You say that this scolding, shaming style may actually make them make the Trump supporters more entrenched in their position instead of moving away from it. But are scolding scolders doing the very thing you criticize them for?"
Yeah, but it's okay. I'm only one person.
Okay.
I'm describing millions of people. I'm just one person, Jude. So your friend can rest easy knowing that the scolding liberals of Bethesda and I should say the scolding liberals of Leewood can sleep easy. They'll never even know about this. I mean, I think this is one of the best points of the book, and I wish your listeners knew more about what I meant by the liberalism of scolding. You know, that it's a kind of liberalism that it can't build a mass movement, but it can feel real goddamn good about itself.
I hear it all the time among people I know, you know, who just, you know, why did those 73 million people vote for Trump? They must be stupid.
I know. And it goes further than that. And the whole masking thing, you know, it makes me so mad that COVID immediately, a global epidemic turned into a culture war here in America. We all took sides on it and like wear masks or not wear masks. And it's just absolutely nuts. And then scolding people for not wearing masks, or alternately, I've heard of people scolding others for wearing masks. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That goes on around here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shaming.
I've seen it both ways, the shaming and the scolding, but like it's only in America does that. Well, I don't know about that. The thing is that we could be building a movement in this country, and instead we liberals, people on the left, could be building a mass movement. The way you build a mass movement is by accepting other people as they are and building them up, you know, and educating them up. And that's not what we do. We're much more interested in scolding people for being stupid because it's enormously gratifying. But you're not going to build a movement that way. Right. So there you go.
Right. Well, that's a good answer. Thank you very much, Thomas Frank. We've been talking to Thomas Frank, author of The People Know. Or no, I got that wrong. Thank you. A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Appreciate it.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. So in honor of our new president and the work that he did yesterday, I thought maybe I'd take a few minutes to go over the various executive orders that President Biden signed yesterday on his first day in office. Many of them had to do with COVID-19 and his plan to try to get this virus under control. So he signed an executive order, for example, requiring that all people wear masks and maintain social distancing on any federal property. He also signed an order that would launch a 100 days of masking challenge, which encourages Americans to wear masks. He also signed an order that would reverse the prior administration's decision to remove the U.S. from the World Health Organization. And according to CNN, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, will lead the American delegation to the World Health Organization. He signed an executive order that creates a position of COVID-19 response coordinator and restores the Directorate for Health, for Global Health Security and Biodefense, a team that will be in charge of the pandemic response within the National Security Council. He signed an executive order that extends eviction and foreclosure moratoriums until at least March 31st. He extended the existing pause on student loan payments and interest for people with student loans that is scheduled to last at least until September 30th. He signed an instrument that will allow the United States to rejoin the Paris Agreement on climate change within the next 30 days. He signed an executive order with the aim of embedding equality and equity across federal policy and rooting out systematic racism and other barriers to opportunity from federal programs and institutions. The same executive order also disbanded the Trump administration's 1776 commission. He did a number of also immigration-related executive orders. One of them was reversing the prior administration's policy of not counting undocumented immigrants in the census. One of the things that was much looked forward to was a memorandum directing officials to preserve and fortify the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program, which is also known as DACA. The memo strengthens DACA after the prior administration's effort to undo protections for undocumented people who were brought to the country. He also did an executive action repealing two proclamations informally called the Muslim Ban, which restricted entry to the U.S. from majority Muslim countries and many African countries. He also wrote an executive order revoking Trump's harsh and extreme immigration enforcement and directing agencies to set immigration policy more in line with the Biden administration's values and priorities. As a companion to that, Department of Homeland Security and USCIS presented a number of memos related to some of these executive orders, including a moratorium on deportation for at least the next 100 days. One proclamation was directed at stopping construction of the border wall and to determine how to best divert those funds elsewhere. Another one was a memorandum that extended the designation allowing Liberians who have been in the United States for a long time to remain and block the deportation of Liberians who have been living in the United States. So this is basically a continuation of TPS for Liberians. He also strengthened protections for the LGBT community, signing an executive order directing government to interpret the Civil Rights Act to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, in addition to race, color, sex, and national origin. He signed an executive order enacting new ethics rules for government officials, and finally, an executive order revising regulatory process executive orders enacted by the Trump administration and orders the OMB director to develop recommendations to modernize regulatory reviews and reverses Trump's regulatory approval process. These are just the executive orders for the first day. There will probably be more in the coming weeks, but that's all the time we have for tonight. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights.
Okay, and that's it for the show tonight. Our calendar is on our webpage, on our Facebook page. We don't have time to read it tonight. Stay tuned for, tune in next week. The Heartland Labor Forum is going to have an interview with Mike Stout on his new book on the Homestead Steel Mill, the final 10 years. And we're going to be talking about Reverend James Lawson and a new movie about him called Love and Solidarity. He's had an amazing life. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's River City Chautauqua with philosophy, music, and science.
There is no disgrace in standing side by side with